As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Season 3, Episode 26, The Mountain of Iron. Welcome back to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. Before we get started today, we have new members of the House of Lords. Charles Merrick, Earl of Strathern, Kieran Gore, Earl of Chelsea, Matthew Molaris, the Earl of Inverkeithing, and Viscount Colander. All patrons get their own premium RSS feed that lets them listen to the podcast without ads. And the Earls get access to the bonus content, like the History of the Mughals. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to find out more. Last week, we saw the Battle of Dungeness, as the overconfident States Navy of the Commonwealth of England met the determined and resurgent Navy of the United Provinces of the Netherlands. Dutch Admiral Martin Tromp, back in command after the politicians accepted that they needed him, bested the English Admiral, Robert Blake, in a battle which left three English ships as prizes of the Dutch, and one Dutch ship burning to the waterline. Though Tromp had outnumbered Blake, the larger size and firepower of the English ships was still a difficult obstacle to overcome. Blake had taken his fleet to the shelter of the Thames estuary, where Tromp could not follow. We left off last week with the Dutch making the most of their uncontested dominance of the English Channel and North Sea, capturing English shipping by the boatload and throwing their weight around against neutral countries in a way which was rapidly burning through their international support. Dungeness shattered a fantasy held by many people in the English government and the English public at large, that the war was practically over after Kentish Knock. The Dutch had not been beaten, after all, and if the English Republic was going to restore its rightful place as the most powerful nation sailing the waves, then the States Navy needed reform. Blake and Tromp had many parallels to one another. Both were aggressive commanders, they were both brave in battle, and both could see the flaws in their respective fleets. Just like Tromp had after Kentish Knock, Blake wrote to his political masters and informed them of the flaws of the Navy, and his suggestions to fix them. Unlike the States General, which was laden with tradition and riven with faction between the Admiralties, the Commonwealth of England was a revolutionary regime. It had, to quote Hainsworth and Churches, a, quote, capacity for effective action and decision, end quote. The first decision, and the bedrock of any changes, was money. Last week I described how the money had dried up. Now, stung by the defeat of Dungeness, the Rump Parliament voted to raise the monthly assessment, taxes levied on communities, from £90,000 to £120,000. The size of the standing army would be reduced to cost only £80,000 a month, with the remaining £40,000 set aside for the Navy. More money was found by the selling and leasing of the estates and palaces of exiled royalists, and this went straight to the Navy Treasury. This flood of cash restored confidence in the shipbuilders, and work picked up immediately. Hundreds of labourers were hired in ports across the southern coast of England and into the Thames estuary, all working to repair damaged ships, refit merchantmen into warships, and build new ones from scratch. As we covered off last week, the Dutch had pressured the Danes to cut off English access to the Baltic trade and the wealth of naval supplies sourced from the forests of Sweden and Eastern Europe. So, the Commonwealth looked elsewhere. Within the Commonwealth itself, from the forests of Scotland and the untapped resources of the American colonies and the northern markets of Norway, where the Dutch could less easily reach. With the dockyards building ships, the Republic needed men to crew them. Pay was increasing from 19 shillings a month to 24 shillings a month for ordinary sailors, and higher ranks and more veteran sailors received pay rises too. Many sailors had grumbled at the pay they were owed, and special efforts were made to pay these arrears. It was never enough, though, and the government would frequently resort to sending in the army to put down mutinous sailors, refusing to leave their ships until they were paid what they were owed. Besides pay, other rewards for service were increased. Capturing a ship as a prize meant a bounty to help encourage boarders, and the shares of this bounty given to crews was increased to compete with what privateers could offer. All of this increased the rate of enlistment and reduced the flow of desertion, but it still wasn't enough to meet the requirements of the revived shipbuilding programme. So the Commonwealth resorted to conscription. Sailors between the age of 15 and 50 were impressed from coastal communities all across England, in numbers rarely seen before. Sometimes the people in charge of recruitment, naval officers at sea and constables and pressmasters on land, sometimes they stuck to volunteers, limiting themselves to persuasion. Most were not so gentle, and quickly resorted to force. The targets of recruitment also varied. It was meant to be limited to men experienced in sailing, so fishermen, merchant sailors and the like, or those with useful skills, like coopers or carpenters, who might have a bit of seasickness but could bring something valuable to the crew. Of course, pressmasters also took those without particularly useful skills aboard a ship, like farmers and thatchers, because they were paid by the body. By June 1653, an estimated 5,000 men had been impressed from coastal communities. Local authorities and public opinion frequently sided with those conscripted over the officials sent to conscript. Of course, a good source of experienced sailors would be at sea already, and this was also prime hunting for impressment. Usually, impressment was forbidden against ships outward bound. They'd need their crew for the journey, although exceptions were occasionally made. One regular source of sailors was the Newcastle coal fleet, which was put in the unenviable position during the Anglo-Dutch War of having reason to fear both the Dutch and those assigned to protect them from the Dutch. And this fear wasn't without good reason. Many sailors were pinched from the coal fleets because they were sailing in home waters and there was little danger in leaving their ships undermanned. The state's navy occasionally had to fire its guns on the convoy it was meant to be protecting to scare them into submission, because they were running away from them. This is also when the government transferred soldiers from the new model army into the navy. More than 1,000 soldiers were stationed on the ships of the state's navy, both to stiffen morale and discipline the soldiers, and also to lead boarding actions. The foundation of the 1st Regiment of Royal Marines is still a decade away. You need royalty to have Royal Marines. But Churches and Haynesworth propose that this should be seen as the real founding, in the disciplined men of the new model army fighting on the waves for the Republic. This leaves the officers. Blake, though he accepted responsibility for Dungeness, reported how many captains and lower officers shrank in the face of their duty. These complaints were taken seriously. Several captains were removed from their posts and ordered to explain their conduct in London. None were convicted of any wrongdoing, but Blake had won the argument. The Council of State and the Naval Administration placed more dedicated captains, particularly officers with experience of naval warfare, on their warships, and began to phase out the drafted merchantmen. These armed auxiliaries were good for bulking out a fleet, but Blake and the other admirals and generals at sea were advocating for quality over quantity. A merchant captain may be an experienced sailor, who may have gotten into some fights over the years. but too often they were more focused on their own priorities, either the safety of themselves, their crews and their ships, or plunder. To once again quote from Churches and Hainsworth, they saw a battle as a free-for-all to which their admiral had invited them, in which their objective was to batter an enemy ship into submission and then make a prize of it for the profit of themselves and their eager crews, end quote. This all reminds me of the parliamentarian army before the new modelling. Individual officers and commanders working towards their own ends with limited overall command and general direction. The Navy had already been remodelled into the States Navy already, but it was clearly incomplete. In the wake of Dungeness, the need to enforce discipline became very clear. New laws of war were drafted and imposed on the fleet. Distributed on Christmas Day 1652, and in use with only minor revisions for another century, copies were displayed on every ship of the States Navy and regularly read aloud to the crew. Most of the articles focused on discipline, behaviour in battle, and threatened harsh punishments for cowardice and neglecting one's duty, especially for officers. But there were also articles that took a more holistic approach to the Navy. Just as in the New Model Army, piety and good behaviour was encouraged, and sinful behaviour like swearing, drinking, and visiting port brothels was discouraged. Of course, they didn't stop the sailors doing all that anyway, but there are notable cases where individuals were punished for these things. Five examples of treason were explicitly listed, and death was a common punishment for treachery and negligence, although only rarely handed down. Twice between 1649 and 1660, and one of those cases was a captain murdering one of his crew, which would have been the death penalty before the laws of war. More common was the lash, demotion, a fine, or dismissal from service. The lash was often carried out on a small boat in view of all nearby ships. For the first time, the commander-in-chief could hold courts-martial, rather than having to wait for land-based civilian tribunals. As Roger puts it, under the stress of defeat, the rump was forced to concede to the Navy considerably more authority and money than before. Blake offered his resignation, which was rejected out of hand. He would remain as General at Sea, and he oversaw the reorganisation of the States Navy. The chain of command was strengthened. Subordinates could discuss the plan at a council of war, but once they dispersed back to their ships, they were to follow the Admiral's lead. In battle, the fleet would be divided into three squadrons, the Red, White and Blue, which wasn't a new development in itself, but they were reordered. Blake, as Admiral-in-Chief, General at Sea, would usually command the Red Squadron. A Vice Admiral would command the White, and a Rear Admiral would command the Blue. They'd be paid £3, £2 and £1 a day, respectively. Each squadron would be divided into three, Vanguard, Centre and Rear, and each division would have an overall commander. The commanders of Red, White and Blue would also lead the centre divisions of their squadrons. The vanguards and rears would be commanded by a vice admiral and a rear admiral, respectively. If you're struggling to visualise this, because I certainly was, imagine three columns left to right, red, white and blue, and then three rows in each column at the front, middle and centre. This drastically increased the links in a chain of command. Before, a fleet of 50 to 80 ships would have to follow the lead of a single admiral-in-chief who might be engaged in fighting, barely visible through the battle, incapacitated, or just too far away. Under the new system, there was much less chance of the fleet becoming leaderless. Redundancies were built into the chain. Every ship in every part of the fleet knew who to follow. Other reforms took place on land. The Admiralty Committee was replaced by a smaller, six-man Admiralty Commission, directly responsible to the Rump Parliament. This body was dominated by Henry Vane the Younger and his allies, who were energetic and devoted independents, and they worked efficiently to ensure that the States Navy had what it needed. Over December 1652 and January 1653, the States Navy underwent these changes. In dockyards from the Thames to Plymouth and the corridors of power in Westminster, a resurgent, revolutionary energy flowed into the fleet. The fleet, which Blake led out of the Thames estuary, numbered at least 52 strong. He was joined by generals at sea George Monk and Richard Dean. Blake and Dean were on Blake's flagship, the Triumph, and they commanded the Red Squadron, with the Baptist John Lawson serving as their vice admiral. Monk was meant to be on shore, but decided to come along anyway, and he led the White Squadron on the vanguard. Vice Admiral Penn commanded the Blue Squadron from the Speaker. Soon after Blake sailed on the 10th of February, reinforcements from other ports joined his force, and the fleet grew to about 70 ships. A large proportion were second and third rate ships, large vessels which packed a punch. The fleet lacked the two great ships, the first rates Sovereign and Resolution, which were still undertaking repairs. Reaching Dover, the fleet embarked 1,200 soldiers, fresh from Cromwell's army. Blake complained to the Council of State that he was still undermanned, but he nevertheless set out on his hunt. Somewhere out there was Admiral Tromp, and Blake wanted a rematch.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
While the state's navy was being remodeled, Tromp had been sailing the English Channel, more or less, unmolested. By the end of January, he sailed from the Ile de Ré with about 75 warships, escorting a convoy of more than 150 merchantmen back to the Netherlands. From information received from neutral ships, one of the costs of Dutch heavy-handedness, Blake knew that Tromp was on the move, but he didn't know which route he'd take. The English Channel is a narrow sea, but it wasn't that narrow, and Blake had lost track of at least one Dutch fleet under De Ruyter once before. Blake didn't send out ships to scout, though, and instead led the fleet back and forth across the channel, watching for any sign of the approaching Dutch. This patrol of the channel led to the three squadrons becoming spread out. Meanwhile, Tromp led his fleet and the convoy east, hugging the English coast as he went. On the 18th of February, the two fleets finally caught sight of each other off the Isle of Portland, just off the Dorset coast. Well, part of Blake's fleet saw the whole of Tromp's fleet. In escorting the merchantmen, Tromp had kept his warships together. Blake's patrol had spread his fleet dangerously thin. Blake's Red Squadron had been separated over the night, and his rearguard was several miles away in the morning. Penn, commanding the Blue, was far to Blake's west, while Monk, commanding the White, was far to the south, barely in sight. To make these matters worse, the Dutch had the weather gauge, and the separated English fleet had to tack against the wind all day trying to come to Blake's aid. Because Blake needed aid. Tromp, eager for a fight as ever, saw Blake's flagship relatively isolated. The Red Squadron around Blake numbered only about 20 ships, and Tromp ordered four Dutch squadrons, under himself, Evertsen, De Ruyter, and Florisoon, to charge the vulnerable admiral. 88 ships against 20, with their reinforcements several hours away. Against those odds, a more cautious admiral might think that discretion was the better part of valour, and fall back to allow the rest of the fleet to catch up. But this was Robert Blake. Besides his preference for action, which was definitely a large part of his decision-making, he was worried that Tromp wouldn't chase him if he fell back, and would instead sail away with a convoy. Just as with De Witt, Blake seems to have believed that his opponent would prioritise the safety of the merchant ships, and just as with De Witt, this was a mistake. Tromp wanted this fight. Blake had other concerns. If he fell back to buy time for reinforcements, and Tromp chased him, then one of his reinforcements thought he was actually running away. Flag signalling was an immature science, and there was a chance that Penn, Monk, and Lawson might misunderstand his intentions and make their own escape, accepting what they believed to be their commander's judgment that this wasn't a fight they wanted. Far better for Blake to communicate his intentions in the clearest way possible. A broadside or seven. He'd just have to hope the rest of the fleet reached him before he was overwhelmed. So Blake's 20 ships met Tromp's 80-plus at about 9 in the morning, and they greeted each other with deafening broadsides which could be heard as far away as Portsmouth. Admiral Florisoon boldly charged Blake's squadron, but he was left unsupported by the rest of the ships under his command. His ship was then pummeled by 10 frigates, with parts of his rigging smashing to the deck. Florisoon managed to avoid capture or destruction, with relatively few crew killed, 8, but many more were wounded, and he sat out the rest of the battle undertaking repairs. Meanwhile, the Brederode and the Triumph, flagships of Tromp and Blake, battered each other with broadsides. Tromp later recorded his admiration for the English captain's loyalty towards their commander, as several moved to support Blake. When he attacked the Triumph, quote, "I had such a welcome from 3 or 4 of his ships that everything on board was on fire," end quote. He was exaggerating for dramatic effect. The same could not be said for the Triumph. In the hour it took for more of the English fleet to arrive and assist, the Triumph was fighting the Brederode and at least 6 other Dutch vessels. Tromp's numbers advantage was taking a toll. In broadside after broadside, the Triumph was hammered by cannon fire. But as we'll cover in a moment, Dutch fire was still aimed at the rigging. Relatively few shots were aimed at the hull of the ship. But that relatively few is very relative indeed. 7 ships, firing for over an hour, means a lot of cannonballs, and though the Triumph was never in danger of sinking, the fighting was taking a toll on the crew. It was reported that of the 350 sailors aboard the English flagship, 100 were dead by the end of the fighting. This included the captain of the Triumph, Andrew Ball, and Blake's secretary. Blake himself was injured when a bar iron shot ripped through his leg, narrowly avoiding taking off the limb or killing him outright. He refused to go below decks to be treated because of the effect it would have on morale. A bar iron shot, if you're curious, was designed for damaging masts and rigging. Imagine either 2 round cannonballs or 1 round cannonball in 2 halves with a bar of iron connecting them. Similar to chain shot, bar iron shot would spin through the air at high speed. Safe to say, Blake was very lucky. Like at Kentish Knock, English and Dutch gunnery was noticeably different in both its targets and its discipline. The Dutch still pursued their disable and board tactics, aiming for the rigging with things like bar shot, whereas the English aimed at the hull, specifically at the round timbers, where the hull curved down towards the waterline below the tumble home. Shot holes here were very dangerous for a ship's future above the waves, for obvious reasons. Meanwhile, the rest of the English fleet began to join the fight. Penn's squadron, the Blue, approached from the west. As soon as Blake had made his intentions clear, he'd pivoted his ships around, and the Blue now exchanged fire, first with the squadron of Evertsen, and then with ships commanded by De Ruyter. De Ruyter captured 2 English ships, one of them was the merchantman Prosperous. As De Ruyter prepared to sail away with his prizes, he found himself surrounded by 5 English ships from Monk's White Squadron. Things looked very dicey for De Ruyter when his fellow Zealander, Evertsen, led a rescue. The English ships were forced aside, and a space was made for De Ruyter to withdraw aboard his heavily damaged ship. The Prosperous was recaptured. That story repeated for the rest of the day. Early on, when the numbers were in their favour, the Dutch tactics of disable and board had worked very well. But as the scattered English squadrons arrived, the tide drastically turned. The English tactic of smash and sink took a deadly toll on the smaller Dutch warships. Many Dutch victories earlier in the battle were soon reversed, as Dutch warships were driven off, sunk, or captured, and the prize crews aboard captured English ships were forced to surrender. More than once, Dutch ships sailed towards an English vessel intending to board it, only to face the disciplined gunnery of the state's navy. vast broadsides fired in unison at the ringing of the ship's bell forced more than one boarding attempt to be called off. Many Dutch ships were sunk or destroyed, with one exploding after its gunpowder stores were ignited. In one dramatic action, as an example, the English warship Advice was boarded by ships on both sides, with three other Dutch vessels providing support. As the Advice's crew and marine force battled across the deck, the gunners carried on their work, firing point blank into the boarding ships which were lashed to them. This was very risky. Fire or explosion could kill them all, but it was effective. English reinforcements arrived, driving off the boarder's support. The portside boarder was boarded on their own port side, as the starboard boarder was cut free and drifted away. The Advice's point-blank firing deep into the guts of the enemy ships took their toll. The adrift attacker sank, her captain defiantly holding his sword above his head as his ship went down with all hands. On the other side, the ship abruptly and quickly went down after the Advice's guns devastated its hull. Only the captain and six other crew managed to jump aboard the English ships. The Advice had seen 35 crew killed and many more wounded, but her attackers had paid a much heavier price. When Tromp spotted several English frigates sailing towards the Dutch convoy, he began his withdrawal. His frustration must have been incredible. When the fighting had begun, everything was in his favour. He had the numbers, he had the experience, he even had the sodding wind. Here he was, one of his country's most accomplished naval commanders, who had spent decades at sea learning the ways of naval warfare, and his opponent was an amateur. A talented amateur, yes, but Blake and Monk and Dean weren't sailors. They were army men, they were soldiers. Blake had made amateur mistakes. He wasn't scouting, he let his fleet spread out. Blake had handed himself up on a silver platter, 20 ships against Tromp's whole fleet. Tromp had swept down on him within an hour. Both Blake and the Triumph should have been in Dutch hands, and the Battle of Portland should have been a clear Dutch victory. And yet here they all were at the end of the day. Half a dozen Dutch ships were at the bottom of the channel. Another half dozen were English prizes. One had exploded. Most of his ships were pumping water out of their hulls just to stay afloat. Their ammunition was almost spent, and morale was below the waterline. Compare this to the English. The fleet of the States Navy had taken a beating, especially the Triumph, but Blake had only lost one ship, a merchantman, which had to be scuttled. Three or four others had sailed away to Portsmouth for repairs, but that was it. His fleet was now all in one place, so any numbers advantage Tromp might have held was gone, and the English still had ammunition. Portland played to Blake's strengths. His army career during the Civil Wars displays his talents as a defensive commander. He defended the sieges of Lyme Regis and Taunton with grit and skill. What was the first hour or so of the Battle of Portland, if not a siege? Surrounded by a larger force, relying on his artillery, his heavier ships acting as castle walls, and him knowing that he just needed to hold out until reinforcements arrived to lift the siege. At Portland, Blake really earned his title. General at sea. Overnight, both fleets made whatever repairs they could, and Tromp shared out what limited ammunition and gunpowder he had left. They kept sailing east, lighting up their positions with lamps, and any stragglers were set upon by Monk's fast frigates. This included a vast 1,200-ton merchantman called the Ostrich, which had taken serious losses in the battle. The wounded were taken onto another ship as the Ostrich was towed, but it had to be abandoned in the morning, and it was taken by the frigates. The Holland, slowed by the loss of a mast, was caught, her crew was removed and then scuttled by the pursuing English. Tromp formed his fleet into a crescent between the pursuing English and the merchant convoy. The sound of pumps echoed over the water, interrupted by occasional cannon fire. As the ships neared the Isle of Wight, the fastest English ships caught up to the Dutch. Two more Dutch ships were captured, with one scuttled. Afterwards, De Ruyter's ship had to be towed, and Florissoon's freshly replaced rigging was destroyed again. After a day of a chase, night fell, and Tromp ordered the remaining ammunition rationed out. The next morning, the sun rose on an increasingly desperate Dutch fleet, Several captains attempted to desert, and when Tromp had them brought to him, they said they had nothing left to fight with. He had them take position at the centre of the convoy. The merchantmen didn't know they had no ammunition, and they'd be reassured by their presence, or at least that was the hope. Throughout the morning, the chase continued. Several more ships, both warships and merchantmen from the convoy, were cornered and captured, or sunk. Tromp led his fleets south, and by the late afternoon of the 20th of February, they were off the French coast. The English fleet was on their tail, with the wind at their back as the light began to fade. Tromp anchored his ships off the cliffs of Cap Grenet, slightly to the west of Calais. Blake watched, and as the sun set, ordered his fleet to stick close and keep their lamps on. In the shadows of the cliffs, the Dutch fleet bobbed without lanterns. In the morning, Tromp would have nowhere to go. When the sun rose, Blake looked out in astonishment. Instead of a forest of tattered and broken masts, Cap Grenet was empty. Here, he discovered the difference between himself, a general at sea, and a sailor who had been on the ocean since he was 10 years old. Tromp knew these waters. He knew his talents, and he trusted in the seamanship of his crews. In the dead of night, he led the remains of his 80-ship fleet and the 150-ship convoy through a deep channel of water. Over the following days, Tromp's fleet suffered through rough weather. More and more ships had to be towed, pumps were running non-stop, and Florissant's mast, the third one since Portland, snapped and went overboard. But the English, though still chasing, were safely far away. Tromp's disappearing act had given them the head start they needed to get home, and by the 3rd of March, they anchored off Dunkirk. About 70 ships were still with Tromp at this point, and that is including the merchant convoy. Most of those missing ships were not captured or sunk, though, and had instead taken their own chances, or got lost in the night, and were scattered across the channel or in neutral ports. Blake decided not to risk the weather, and he took his battered ships home, disappointed that Tromp had got away. The celebrations in the Commonwealth and in Westminster were unconcerned about that pessimism, though there was none of the naivety which had followed Kentish Knock. Mistakes had been made, everyone knew that, and especially George Monk. Like Blake, he was an army man with little naval experience. Portland was his first battle. But some principles applied to the sea as much as to land. Principles like scouting for your enemy and concentrating forces. In terms of numbers, Churches and Hainsworth state that the Dutch lost 17 warships and 60 merchantmen, sunk or captured over the 3 days of battle and pursuit. Roger puts the numbers lower, at 9 warships and 24 merchantmen. Either way, the Battle of Portland was the worst disaster in Dutch naval history. Next time, we will finish off the First Anglo-Dutch War. Thank you to my House of Lords, including the King's Favourite, Mike Sanders, the Duke of Newcastle, Jonathan Williams, the Marquess of Dorset, Thomas Kessler, and the Countess of Clarendon, Mandy Wright. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to join their ranks and listen to the podcast without ads. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or recommend it to a friend. For other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, such as the History of the Second World War, check out airwavemedia.com. Thank you to Sounds Like an Earful for the interval music in today's episode, to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.